The Town of Discovery Bay, regular CSD board meeting is now in order. Would you all please rise and follow Director Lee in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Roll call has been taken and let the record reflect, all members are present.
Thank you. This is the time when we have public comment. And I believe we have one that's actually put a card in, Bill Helfer. You know all the rules and regulations.
I don't have to.
Welcome back.
Took a couple of meetings off. My name is Bill Helfer. I live at 661 Beaver Court here in Discovery Bay. I want to congratulate whoever was in charge of getting the traffic worked on out front at the intersection. I think I'm real pleased to see something was done, especially with the poles. It appears to me, though, that the white poles would, you know, fix the problem of the people flying west on Highway 4, trying to cut through the right turn lane. Like possibly, yellow poles could be removed. I don't see where they serve much purpose other than in the way to make a left turn. So I was wondering, as a board, in your advisory capacity that you have, if it would be possible to send a letter requesting yellow poles be removed. Because they may not necessarily be necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. And on that, we have received quite a number of, and not responding back, but we have received quite a number of residents giving input, and we're taking all those inputs and taking a look with council. Anybody else? Public comment? Terry? You know the rules, too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I have a little sample survey here that I made copies for each one of you that I'd like to give you to read at your convenience. And I have a little discussion on it, if I may.
If you would give those to the clerk, please. And then we're free to discuss.
Earlier this year, the city of Brentwood, in conjunction with the company Regional Government Services, came up with a plan to upgrade all the parks and recreation in their town. They found about two dozen items they wanted to address. Then they created a survey, which I did, to find out which of these items are important to their constituents. It's truly important to the city of Brentwood to do what they think is best for the city. I brought in copies of these for you to read, take a look at. It would be smart for our town to do something similar. I have extra surveys if anybody else is interested.
Thank you, Terry. Yes, ma'am, you had, I saw your name go up. Well, please come on up. And the rules really are 3 minutes. Try to keep it into that.
Cheryl McDonald, I sat on the board to establish your board. Anyway, I have several things. I want to know if the lake is safe for the kids and dogs and animals to go into it at this point. Number two, we have a real problem with boats and trailers in the driveways and on the streets and taking up all the parking. I can't even get down my street on Shell Court. There's so many cars bumper to bumper and boats. And I know it's a county ordinance that they're not allowed in the driveway. So I'd like this board to tackle this and do the recording or get the inspector out here to do the inspecting. And last, I'd like to give you this picture of the lake when we landscaped the five islands on the lake in 82. Maybe you can frame it and put it with the rest.
And if you put it up to the clerk as well?
You can have
it.
We'll
get it, okay?
We've planted 500 trees and bushes on the 15 acres of islands out there and wildflowers.
Okay.
Community today.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Rob Markinson, been editor for 43 years now. And two things about Cornell Park. Because I know a month ago there was a lot of discussion here, and whenever I live across the street, I'm there at least twice a day in the park. And two of the bathrooms were locked up about 3 weeks ago, the men's day down of water. And about 2 weeks ago, the chains came off and they were open. So yeah, nosy, I'm going in to check them out. No toilet seat covers in any of the bathrooms, men and women. No toilet paper. Looked like they hadn't been cleaned. I've been going over there for the last 2 weeks now, every day, twice a day, to check them out. Because I was told they were paying for a maintenance twice a week to clean them. I don't know if that's true. They have not been cleaned one day in 2 weeks. I have flushed the toilets numerous times because they're gross. No toilet paper, no toilet seat covers. The local gardeners are using the woman's bathroom because it did have a half a roll of toilet paper in it, which is gone. Then yesterday or so, somebody, I don't know if it was somebody, Brian, somebody went and put some rolls of toilet paper, you know, one roll, two rolls in the mid women's. That afternoon, there's only about half a roll left in one of the women's on it. Today, checking it out, there was a half a roll in one bathroom. Something's going on. If we're paying for a service, we should be getting a refund and they should be fired. I don't know who's in charge of it or what's going on, but it's pretty bad. And the male landscapers use the woman's all the time. It's, you know, for you guys to figure out what to do. Second point is the drinking fountain that's been broken for 2 years by the baseball diamond. And I know that because I'm the one that turned it in when it was ready and it wouldn't shut off. And about a week later, I was out there when somebody finally came with the key to open it up and shut off the water. That was a couple of years ago, you know, give or take, whatever. I was told months later, I go, well, we need to fix it. Well, they're old, you can't get parts, and a new one's going to cost $5,000. We don't have the money. Okay, a year and a half later, it's not working. Nobody's ever taken it apart to see. It, you know, is it a spring that's broken, something simple? But I would think that a drinking fountain by the baseball diamond where all the activities going on could be kind of a priority to look at for 2 years, nobody doing anything. And I would like to see if, I know I can't touch it when I haven't wanted to, but if you could just take it off and give it to me, I'm sure myself and I got plumber friends and all that, it'll be fixed. Everything's fixable, you know? Maybe not, but probably we could get it fixed and put it back. So that would be my request, if I could please do that. That's it. That's all. Thank you.
Any other public comments? See, none. I'll close public comments and move on to the consent calendar.
I'll move the consent calendar.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? I did not see Leah.
Leah became ill today.
Okay.
So she went home.
Thank you. And ECCFPD, I see a couple of uniforms.
Good afternoon, good evening. Sorry we missed you guys last time, but we were running a pretty major incident on that meeting, as we're all aware. We're almost all the way through August, and I don't have the numbers for August yet, but I got our July numbers. However, I do realize I wrote myself a typo. So in the month of July, there were roughly 60 calls in Discovery Bay. I wrote down 23 for some reason. I know that's not correct because I wrote the number as 60 plus. Average response time of 10:17. No significant incidents in Discovery Bay in July. For the district, July was 620 calls for service. Average response time of 7:58. That included responding to 10 residential structure fires, 4 commercial fires, 8 vehicle fires, 12 vegetation fires, and 13 exterior fires. We also responded to 26 vehicle accidents. 7 of those required rescue. 1 vehicle versus pedestrian accident. However, in early August, you saw we had 2 major incidents already, and I'll report more on 2 weeks when I come back to the meeting here in 2 weeks. The one was the Marsh incident, which burned up over 740 acres. The other was the Sellers incident. While that was only 58 acres, there was a homeless threat during that incident, and we had a high wind event. I'm not going to talk too much tonight. As you see, I have finally brought Fire Marshal Steve O'Bear with us. He is new to our fire district as of mid-May, so he's just getting used to everything that's going on here. However, he is a familiar face. Steve, while we were contracting with Confire for these type of services, he was our liaison and did a lot of the work out here. So it was an easy fit to bring him on, but he has a big heavy lift. So without further ado, I want to finally introduce Fire Marshal Steve O'Bear.
Good evening, Board. As Chief McCover said, I covered the area for 10 years, so very familiar with a lot of the different occupancies out here. When this was actually a gym and all the other different issues that we have going on within the district. So just a quick kind of glimpse what falls underneath my purview. In the Fire Marshal, we oversee all the fire prevention activities and fire investigation activities throughout the district. So for underneath us, we handle all new construction, inspections of all existing occupancies, and then any type of fire investigation that comes up and we need to go investigate out there. We are currently building very fast. We just made announcements, not only for Fire District aides to come join our district to be able to assist and be able to get a little bit more familiar with the district, but we also put out an announcement for deputy fire marshals as well too. And soon after that, by the end of this year, we expect to have a couple new fire inspectors joining our group as well. So, available for any questions. And thank you for your time.
Welcome aboard. Yeah,
good to see you. Welcome. Thank you.
One more thing I forgot to mention, just for everybody here, September 14th is a hard day for the open house at Station 59. So, mark on your calendar, September 14th, Station 59 on Bixler, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're having the open house. So, bring your families, bring the kids, it'll be a good time.
Steve, I was at your swearing in back over in Brentwood. I don't have any more excited. So, it's nice to have
you. Thank you very much.
Okay, presentations. E1, solar.
You may God bless you.
The general manager abandoned
you. Yeah.
But he's coming back.
That's all right.
I can see what's an empty seat.
Oh, sorry.
We're able to self-introduce. Good evening. All of us, you guys. Feels weird to have my back down, so I apologize. My name is Jody London. I'm the sustainability coordinator for Contra Costa County. With me today is my colleague, Tomo Morera. We will be jointly sharing with you some information about zoning ordinance that the Board of Supervisors has asked us to put together. So what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk a little bit about the county's work on climate action, talk about a clean energy study that we put together last year with a grant from the state, and explain more about the solar overlay ordinance. Let me go back to the, hello, this is a really fast clicker. What's the direction? It's going the wrong way. Drive it upside down. There it is, okay. Why do we have a climate action plan? In 2015, the Board of Supervisors in Contra Costa County adopted a climate action plan to look at how we can have better air quality, reduce pollution, improve our health, think about how we're going to deal with changes that, you know, the impacts of changing climate, particularly in this area. Rising water levels could be of concern to you, as well as drought and extreme heat. These are all things that we see happening right now in our environment. If you read the news, you see that happening. There's a lot of state requirements as well that have been coming online, and we see a lot of benefits that are in addition to the climate in terms of enhancing our quality of life, lower energy bills, when we have a climate action plan. So that's what's in our 2015 climate action plan. I started at the county in June of 2016, so this document predates my service with the county. Okay, I'm clicker challenged. Is it like behind me? Is it, I'm sorry.
Oh, you should be able to point.
Where am I pointing at that? Yeah, I am. So, in our 2015 climate action plan, there are some goals. I'm not gonna read through these. The point is that the county set some goals around alternative energy, clean energy. When we say that, we're talking in particular about wind, solar, and the other types of clean energy. I also, this also ties into the ongoing update that the county is engaged in of our general plan. I know that there's been some conversation about that out here, here in this region. This is the first time in 30 years that the county has updated its general plan, which is scheduled to be adopted by December of 2020. As part of that work, we're going to be updating the zoning code, and we're also going to be updating the climate action plan. We're going to be looking in two areas on the climate action plan: government operations and the community-facing piece of it. And the reason I'm telling you all this about the general plan is I love your input. So if you're here as a member of the community, if you're a member of the governing board, my number is on this deck, and I'm happy to talk with you at any time about some of the things we're considering. We're doing some outreach right now with our County Sustainability Commission around the Climate Action Plan, and I would love to come back and do a presentation on that if you're interested, more specifically kind of the things that are coming forward. I should also note that our Sustainability Commission right now does have a vacancy. The alternate seat for District 3 is open, and Supervisor Burgess will be is collecting names and applications, so contact me if you're interested in applying, because we'd love to have more people serve. It ends up being about 6 meetings a year, and Martina's on a Monday evening. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the clean energy potential study that we performed last year. Why am I so quicker challenged? I'm not usually so.
Still not working.
It could be a battery.
Yeah, it could be. Let me,
if you could advance it, thank you. So last year, looking at the goals that had been set for us in the 2015 Climate Action Plan, we said, okay, we want to really get a handle on this. Do we really have the potential to have more solar and wind and other types of clean energy in Contra Costa County? So we got a small grant from the state of California. We put together a study with a group called the Cadmus Group, and we looked at opportunities to develop different types of clean energy throughout the county. 7 of our cities also contributed some funding of their own so they could take advantage of the consultants being on board, and they did a similar kind of analysis for their own jurisdictions of what's the potential there. Next slide, please. So what are the key findings? We were looking looking across the county, and we found that anywhere from 50 to 83% of the total energy used in Contra Costa County could be generated here in the county if we looked only at the technical potential. There's obviously a lot of political and economic considerations that would come into play as well. When we look at the potential for solar energy, which is, as you'll see in a minute, by far the most available source, there's a pretty even split between existing rooftops and parking structures within the urban limit line and undeveloped parcels outside of the urban limit line in the more rural areas. We know, and a lot of the developers participated in this process, and they were very clear with us that it's much more cost effective for them to develop on undeveloped parcels, but we also recognize that there are a lot of trade-offs involved in that, particularly around agriculture and open space, which are very important and key values in Contra Costa County. We can move on. So what does the technical potential look like? Relevant to you all out here in East County, the total potential for solar is pretty great. The low end is at about 2,500 megawatts. High end, 4,400 megawatts. I'm going to tell you in a minute what that translates into, because I always forget. And when we look at agricultural land with constraints, we see that there's a sizable opportunity with ag lands that have some constraints on it. And as you'll see as we get into this a little more, there are obviously areas that we're not going to develop at all. If we can go to the next slide. So just to put this in context, 1 megawatt of solar energy can power about 250 households. And to create 1 megawatt of solar from ground mounted, the panels you see, so like a solar farm, you need about 7.5 acres. So I'll let you look at this more at your leisure, but this is just a little bit of context. We can go to the next slide. So I'm going to turn it over now to Thelma, and she's going to talk to you some more about what our study found and the proposed solar overlay ordinance that we're developing at the direction of our board.
Hello, good evening. My name is Thelma Moreira. I am a same department as Jody London, and I work in current planning. So as Jody mentioned, we had a study last year that was finalized, and the study looked at the entire county. So as we, as you mentioned, solar is actually the biggest resource of energy. And we looked at every, all over the county, and we looking at the map, so we looked at where can we put solar facilities? And we thought about parking lots, lands that we call urban land unlikely to be developed in purple. And we also looked at the agricultural areas. So we saw there would be a big potential for putting ground-mounted facilities on agricultural areas. So this is an example of property that it's not very good for development. You know, the one in purple means that it's either too small or easy to get access to, and that will be pretty much ideal for installing solar on urban areas. And you see in the left there, we have top of buildings. It would be a good idea to put solar on the roof of structures. Next slide. So as part of the demand recommendation, we got approved from the board to have consider installation of solar on agricultural areas. So as you see that option one there, where we have those little bubbles, those are agricultural areas that were chosen because they are mainly outside of the agricultural core, and we took in consideration, you know, they are not very close to the sensitive areas of the Delta. They are pretty much outside of the habitat conservation area. And the total of this land, if it gets all developed, it's something like 7,300 acres. And for that reason, we are, next slide, we are designing a solar overlay ordinance. So what we're gonna do is allow solar facilities on the agricultural areas that I mentioned to you with a land use permit. I just want to back up. This is my last slide, so I just want to give a little background. So the county ordinance and the general plan allowed only wind farms and wind energy not very long ago, and it still does. But solar is actually something new. And back in 2018, the Board of Supervisors actually allowed some changes in the general plan to say, let's allow solar facilities in commercial and industrial areas of the county. So now that's allowed if you have a land use. As part of the zoning tax amendment, what we want to do is to consider solar facilities to be allowed by right on commercial and industrial. If they are integrated with the building, if they are on the top of the structures, on carports, so we're considering that they will not need a land use, but on the agriculture area, they're going to need a land use. So we are actually right now designing this, what is called the solar overlay ordinance. So we are not going to need to change any general plan. The zone is going to remain the same. And we are going to, as I said, require land use, and that's going to be a discretionary application that will be shared with the maps, that will be shared with you. And the areas that we saw in the previous map is Bedford Island, Jersey Island, and the strip there next to, you know, to here, the Bayou area. So the solar ordinance is going to help, you know, the requirements of height setbacks. We're going to have landscaping whenever it's feasible. And of course, we're going to have a reclamation requirement too in case they, you know, move out to have the reclamation plan. So the ordinance is being designed right now. It's not finalized. And once it becomes available, we are going to, it's going to be available to the public. We're going to provide that online, and you are going to have a chance to receive a copy of it. And if you want to comment, it will be presented to the County Planning Commission first, because the Board of Supervisors is the ones who make the decision on it. So it will be presented as a draft to the County Planning Commission. So this is where we are right now. So this is like a really positive step towards accomplishing what the study told us, you know, reviewed to us, especially regarding solar. And I'm, do you want to add something else? If you have any questions?
Is there any funding for someone that wanted to do solar coming from the county?
At this point, the county hasn't established funds, but we have seen part of one of the reasons we've done this is that we were getting a lot of inquiries from developers. We actually had a couple of permits applications filed. They actually didn't follow through on it, but we wanted to, we've definitely seen interest on the commercial side. Also, MCE, the Community Choice Energy outfit from which many of us are now buying electricity, has what they call a feed-in tariff, where they give a special rate to someone who develops a solar project, and then they buy the electricity and sell it back and turn to their customers.
In the course of your development of this plan, have you talked to the agricultural community to see what their feedback is?
We had a series of stakeholder meetings as we put the study together, and you can find the study on our website, or I can direct it to you. So we did have some engagement from the agricultural community, and we were very sensitive. If you go in and actually read the report, it talks in a fair amount of detail, and there are maps that look at the different layers and the different zoning and the, how we ended up at where we did.
Thank you. Okay, time frame for when you expect this to be done? I know it sounds like you feel it's close, but what's the sign of
it? Yes, we are very anxious to get it done, and we're hoping to get it before the end of the year. This is our hope.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Very
important.
On to E2, Pantages update.
Yes, we have an update on Pantages, and I'd like to invite Trevor Smith and Mark Armstrong to come up to do this presentation.
Strong with Pantages. The Atlas every day. Our company's been involved in this project site for way too many years. We first approved in 2009. We modified the project, the waterfront community, thermal lots with deep water access and docks. And very desirable place for that because it's fast water right nearby. We modified that project a bit in, I think it was 2015, and thereafter pursued with a lot of hard work and expense in going through the environmental permitting process with the Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries, and it's been difficult. We've just come to a place where we don't think we're going to get very far with them. They're not enthusiastic about this project. I think the idea is they don't like the idea of one more boat being on the Delta from this area. Very painful. So we spent a lot of money, worked on it, and we don't see it in sight. We've been doing this for 15 years now, really, on this project, and as a result, we like to come to a project that is environmentally more friendly and is something that the resource agencies, we're pretty confident, will approve. The application is for a 277 unit lake project, a couple of lakes, no waterfront lots, no disturbing Kellogg Creek, none of those issues involved. We have an application on file with the county at this point. And we expect to be able to get through that process probably over the next 4, 5, 6 months. And then we'll be doing LAFCO, either concurrent with that or afterwards. We need to annex into, a portion of our property is annexed into your district now, or in your district now. Balance needs to be included in the district as well. And we would want to de-annex from Reclamation District 800. There'll be no obligations we have over with Rec 800 because we're staying away from Kellogg Creek. We're staying away from the wetlands and marsh on the northerly side of the property. We're trying to do a we've conceded to the Corps and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife folks that we're not able to do the plan that we have before. It's a plan we like very much. We're sad to see we have to do something different, but we think this would be a great project as well. My partner, Trevor Smith, can give a little presentation on the new project's life.
Mark's hair went gray and I lost mine on this project. So I was hired, I've been involved in it for about 10 years and I put a little presentation, I'll quickly go through so you can see what he was talking about, give us some color. I was hired full time to be part of this Pantages group about 2 years ago. And the challenge I was given was take the project that's approved and go get it permitted and go get and get the construction costs nailed down. So just to jump to the first slide, as Mark mentioned, part of it's in your jurisdiction. Do I have
this slide?
Sorry. Okay. So we're part of your jurisdiction, as Mark mentioned. Next slide. Just for the audience's sake, as you go down the end of Point and Timber to the east at the terminus, you come to the cul-de-sac. This is the Pantages property. Next slide. This is a panoramic view. The thing I'd like to point out on this slide, if you're looking to the south, to the right on the picture, you see the homes, the existing neighborhood. To the left, you see the Lakes community. And you see the elevation. They're about 5 feet a little higher. That's the challenge on this property. We got to get up above the floodplain, obviously, but also the expected greenhouse and climate action, the sea level rise, the 2100. So we got to generate dirt on this. And the original plan, next slide, as you can see, we were going to have some bays and coves, hence the name Pantages Bays. We did avoid some of the wetlands to the north, and then there was this open space, that darker green area, which we were using as a mitigation area when dealing with the resource agencies. So the big challenge on the construction side, next slide please, was this shoring wall. It's the darker line where it says 2A, to excavate those three 2A areas. We would excavate out that dirt, but first, before that, put the shoring wall in. Originally, it was going to be a soil cement wall, which is then with I-beam, so it's drilled, soil, wet cement put in, pulled out, an I-beam, steel I-beams dropped in every other boring. The problem became, someone started looking at the wave action on it, and instead of 50 years out, you probably have to replace it for 25 years. And the cost of that was in the tens of millions of dollars. So then we looked at sheet pile, a steel sheet pile, 60 feet long, 10,000 linear feet. It would work, but then it became questionable of the stability on the backside. Do you have to do tiebacks? Do you have to do some soil cement to strengthen that area? And the bids came in at $6.4 to $30 million just for that aspect of the project. So that's where it got complicated. And then I move on to the regulatory stuff, assuming you can always pay your way out of a problem if you have the money. So next slide, please. So The structural, the cost that I just walked you through was the construction element. Then the regulatory element was this portion of the project we call the Kellogg Creek widening. And as Mark walked through all these agencies, we applied, you know, did the applications. National Marine Fisheries wanted to do a biological assessment, take it to the next level, and they just really had concerns about one more boat, one more drop of oil from that boat in the Delta, and what it would do. And we got mired in a lot of back and forth with information and data and spending money to generate that information. We were going nowhere with the applications. And I should mention, there was a 2-year delay, if you guys recall, where they didn't even want us to touch the wetlands. And then through working with lawyers and the Corps, we figured out a way through a Section 10 excavation. So they encouraged us to just take out the full wetland in that northern area. As long as you don't drop dirt into the wetland, you can excavate it out as a dredging project under a Section 10 permit. So that's why the project, kind of the current approved project, came alive again, and I got hired to help get it done. But then we came up to these new delays, these new costs. Next slide, please. So I went to the ownership group and I just said, we really need to take a hard look at the site plan. The resource agent, they want us to avoid the resources. Let's avoid the resources. Let's just take a fresh look at it, put pen to paper, and see what is buildable, you know, where we can get the cost reasonable, make the project attractive to a good builder out there. Next slide, please. So this is what we have come up with. And it's semi a work in progress. We're still working with county staff. As Mark mentioned, there's two lakes, the two bright blue areas. The bigger lake's 25 acres. The smaller lake's around 4.6 acres. We're going to generate the dirt to raise the site from the lakes. Hopefully no import is needed. The CEQA document approves is certified for 292 lots out here. We're at 277. So we're hoping just to do an addendum EIR to get this modified project approved, as Mark mentioned, 4 to 6 months from now. The highlights of it, there would be an HOA. There's a clubhouse at the end of Point of Timber. You can see the little yellow building at the top there next to Kellogg Creek. We've rebranded it as Pantages Trails. We're gonna have over 1.5 miles of trails. If you add in, if someone parked at the end of Point of Timber and decided to walk in and made a left and go to the end of that cul-de-sac, they can jump on the wetland trail, which is 3,800 linear feet, if they walked around that smaller lake and got up to the corner where the clubhouse is, which then they would enter the Kellogg Creek Trail, which is 3,300 linear feet. And we are set back 58 feet from the creek edge. So our plan is the bank of the creek, we don't touch. Resource agencies don't want us to touch it, we're not going to touch it. We'll have 58 feet where we can do a 10-foot DG path to provide access for if HOA has security out there, they can drive it. But more importantly, the public can come enjoy this resource you guys have, which is the Delta, and they can see it and touch it. So then they'll continue on to the end of that other cul-de-sac to the south, the very corner, and then they enter into the subdivision, walk back to Point of Timber. There's gonna be a trail along the northern edge of the lake. So if you can imagine, the Point of Timber would be about 5-6 feet above the lake water, looking down on it. There would be a trail a little lower, connecting two parts at the northeast tip and the northwest tip in the lake area. But the majority of parks, as you can see, those looping roads, there's gonna be over 2.5 acres of active area, grassland, you know, throw the ball, play soccer, and enjoy that view of these wetlands. Next slide, please. One more slide, and I'm gonna come back to that one. So this is, you're at the park, and we're gonna preserve, I like to think it is the little gem of this project, a little piece of, of this natural setting, birds, hiking, jogging, biking. If you go back one slide, I'll just quickly, these are the numbers I cited to you, 277 units, 25 acre lake, main lake, 4, 26. These are the amenities. There's paseos connecting all the trails. If you're internal, you can walk through a paseo, get onto a trail. Clubhouse and the lake, the main lake itself would be an HOA feature. So there might be paddle boats on the lake, but the HOA would maintain them and the lake system. So I talked about the extensive trail system, the 2.5 acres of after parks, and then access. We've talked a few. We are going to make it an option of the builder that comes in. Is it gated or not gated? It will, the approvals of today require a vehicle gate, but the pedestrian can park on pointed timber and walk in and enjoy the public amenities, the parks and the trails. We're going to leave it open to either a gate could be put in or not for the vehicles. So we're going to let the builder make that choice. We're just the developers doing the paperwork, trying to get this approved. If you go a couple forward, just a view of that, a view of what we're going to maintain out there. One more slide, you're done. So we're available to answer any questions you guys have.
When you talk about, so go back about 3 slides, Carol. That, stop right there. That's an existing wetlands that's to the north side, is that correct? And then you're adding another lake just to the right of that?
Yeah, if you go back to the slide, the land plan that shows the two blue lakes.
Go back.
This way
back,
or?
Back one more. Back again?
Back one more.
Okay.
So that features the larger one to
that's
the
what
south,
I thought. So that was looking at this. That was looking this way at that wetlands right there.
Yes.
You're adding another lake. There still are some other wetlands.
Yes.
So, okay.
So the wetlands to the east of the small lake, that was the one that was going to be completely excavated as part of the old project. It'll stay there now. If you go there now, it's a little small grass. And only when it rains, you can see a sheet flow of water, but it's a wetland.
There was also some talk, and I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. There was a discussion when we were talking about Whiting Kennewick Creek and this and that about having a sheriff's substation out there. That's no longer the plan, is that correct?
That is no longer the plan, part of this plan. We have met with the sheriff, and we know we made a commitment, and there was a value to that commitment. So we were looking at those resources we were going to provide and monetize them and let the sheriff decide how to best spend that money.
And then my final question for now is that what, as you turn this over to developers to build, and there may be one or there may be many, I suppose, correct?
Yes.
What assurance do we have, or what confidence level do we have, as assurance is probably the wrong word, that in fact those trails will be remain open to the general public of Discovery Bay, as opposed to having somebody come in and say, you know what, we're going to make that all part of the HOA?
Oh, no, great question. We went out when we started doing, this is about 45, 60 days since we've really turned it up, and we went out to the market and we got a lot of interest, because now it's buildable. And so, the way the deal's going to be structured is we're going to, the 4 to 6 months, we'll get this approved, and there's going to be conditions through the addendum EIR and modified conditions, because a lot of the biological impacts aren't happening now, so that's going to get cleaned up. But all the, how the trails are maintained, they will be conditions of this map, modified map we're getting. And that's your
choice. Looking for the benefit for the entire town, obviously, right. When I ask that question.
Yes.
Thank you. That's all.
Hey, Trevor.
Hi.
Good to see you again. Good. I appreciate you guys letting me tag along with you the other day. It's very informative. I just want to kind of reiterate what we kind of chatted about last week was just, you know, obviously, you know, you don't have full control of the builders that do come in, but you did mention that there's some provisions that you put into the IRR.
Addendum the IRR and the conditions of approval.
I think the biggest challenge that I see is just the balancing of the public access versus the homeowners in that development. We're paying an HOA fee, and you know, if I was a potential homeowner, I'm not sure how much traffic, both vehicle and pedestrian, I'd want going across my front lawn to access the bike trails and the walking trails. So that's just.
And we appreciate your input, and that's what spurred us to say we were headed towards no gate, and that's why we decided to backtrack. We might lose a couple lots at the entrance there to accommodate a gate, but it will be there for the builders to choose.
Well, I'm definitely excited about the project, and I'm glad you guys at least came to a workable solution, so
appreciate it.
Look forward to it.
Thanks.
Yeah, I would just comment, I'm disappointed that you couldn't get the first project through. I understand regulatory problems, and it's a shame. But be it as it may, we're not land use oversight. I have no problem with the project. I think it makes sense.
Thank you.
Just a question on the timing again. This is the next phase is really going to be the one that says you can or can't do that, and that's 4 to 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks.
Four to six months.
Okay.
So we'll go to Planning Commission, then Board of Supervisors for an approved modified tentative map with an addendum EIR.
And that's a green light for you.
Well, then at that point, we will hand it over to the builder, who will then start the improvement plans and really and start engaging. And we're going to engage with you, and we're going to work side by side with the potential buyer. Yeah. So the next 6 months, I hope to see a lot of these spaces.
Okay. Just for clarification, there is a LAFCO process that still needs to be done as well.
Yeah, we need to go through LAFCO and have the rest of the CS, probably talk to by CSD, annexed into there, and de-annex portions that are rep-800 because we're no longer doing anything associated. We're not within the district boundaries and doing anything associated with the district, except for one couple of areas of the property where we're in the district and really shouldn't be at this plan. We're going to end up, there's an issue, we have trails and parks in here. Who's going to maintain them? Who's going to own them? Is it the HOA? We talked to your general manager about the potential for your district to include these trails and open space areas and all the wetlands areas that are being secured be part of a property that could be owned or controlled by the district. Alternatively, an HOA could do it. Then you get into Ryan's comment about conflicts between the HOA and the general public. We're committed, as we were on the waterfront project, to provide access to the public, whether it's going to be access through the gate as the public roads, whether it's going to be accessed by parking at Point of Timber and walking on, right with bike on. We don't know the answer to that. I think that issue is going to be potentially resolved by in this process at the county, in discussions with you and members of the public. I think they would appreciate it. But it's an open question at this point whether it's going to be gated community on private roads or a non-gated community on public roads. I think if it's going to be a gated community, that makes it more difficult for your district to be responsible for its maintenance and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of factors come into play. It's not just, well, it's have a gate or not have a gate. It's who maintains the roads. What about the park and trail system nearby? So we have to talk.
I have one thing.
Yes,
just for clarification, Mark, yeah. And I think Terry addressed it, but so you're talking about a setback off of Kellogg Creek, and therefore any erosion or change to Kellogg Creek would remain the responsibility of Rec 800, and that leaves you guys out of that picture, is that correct? It's part of the plan now, right? I mean, if you're not going to let us do anything, then it's all yours. We have nothing to do with it. Because there is some that occurs over there, and that would pull back the responsibility of Rec 800, correct?
Rec 800 has the opportunity to make corrections and repairs to it. They haven't done it for years. Whether they do it again, remains to be seen.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Well, by the way, your pre-annexation agreement has us required to work with your district to develop a funding mechanism to pay our fair share, our homeowners pay their fair share into vacancy of your parks that they're going to be using as well. So we'll be working on that concurrently as well.
And that's your job. That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentation. Okay, moving on to E3. There's the property located behind the post office off of Fisher Road.
Yes, I'd like to invite the Embarcadero Group up.
Carol, are you ready?
Yeah, pulling in.
Good evening. My name is John Pelosato. I'm a partner with the Embarcadero Group, and I reside in Grass Valley. First, let me say thank you to the board and General Manager Davies for having me here tonight to talk about the project. We met with General Manager Davies last week, and he thought it'd be advantageous for everybody for me to come and talk about the project and get input from the community, and we thought that was a great idea. Do forgive the level of the presentation. We're really just getting started on this, but we thought it would be helpful to get together. As we get further into the process, we welcome the opportunity to come back and talk to you about our progress. So we're talking about the 6.5 acres located behind the Safeway Shopping Center and the post office on Fisher Road. This property was originally planned for a small office park, but it never materialized, mostly due to lack of demand for office space in the area. As we looked at this property, you know, our job is to assess what they call the highest and best value. We've all heard of that. And that would be a mix of the suitability of the land, the community needs, which can obviously change over time, and the economic viability of the project. Based on our analysis, we found that this property would be well suited towards a self-storage facility or a multifamily rental community. As we looked at the community at large, due to the fact there are no multifamily rental communities at all in Discovery Bay, we felt that this is the highest and best use for the property. Can you go to the next? Next one, I'm sorry. I'm a little out of order. Next one, there should be one in between. The general plan? Not my back to go? There it is. Okay, so this was a general plan in Discovery Bay. You can see the dark brown areas are what was general plan for multifamily, high density, by the way. And over time, and I don't know the history near as well as everybody in this room does, but the high density residential got built out with single family homes, townhomes. So we have, and you're familiar with all these, Sand Bay Isle, Harbor Bay, and the homes down in Wayfair Court. And then there's another spot on the northwest corner of Bixler and Highway 4. Again, high density residential, and that was built out with single family homes. So, and maybe, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, there really wasn't a need. There truly is at this point. Can you go a couple more? Because I was just going through, and you guys know where all this stuff is. So these are, I just pulled up on Zillow, what's available to rent in Discovery Bay. They're single family homes averaging $3,000 a home. You know, and when you look at apartments, I like to think of it as transitional housing as much as anything else. People get divorced in California. They need a place to live. Singles who want to live here, mom and dad live here, they don't want to live with mom and dad. They need a place to go. People who are working in Tracy may want to come up here because you guys have the wonderful water. So we think there's a real need for it. We understand that with every development, there are impacts on the community, both good and bad. And so that's why we're here tonight, to get some feedback, see what your concerns may be, see if we can address these issues as we move on, and hopefully have a viable project for you.
Okay. Any questions?
Quick question.
Yes.
As you went through your analysis and, you know, came to the conclusion that you're looking at a multifamily, how many units are you looking at?
125 units.
The questions I would have, I'm sure if the project moved forward, you'd have to go through the county and do all this.
Absolutely.
We can't approve anything on land use. But school impacts, traffic impacts,
So all things we need to look at. As a matter of fact, Mike brought up school impacts, that I guess it's a real nightmare, especially right around here in the morning. And we're not in that district. I don't know if that makes a difference. We're in the Timber Point district. So hopefully it'll be a little easier just running north on Bixler. We originally, when we spoke, it was, oh, you've got to come back down and come into this, which in the morning is, I guess, just people pulling their hair out. So that was some good news, that we're in the Timber Point district. So it's really just this great run up Bixler. But we will have to look at all sorts of things like traffic, everything that any project would have to go through and deal with any mitigation of those impacts that we may have.
I'm not a developer, but one of the things that I would be happy with, maybe a 55 and older rental type of housing development project.
We haven't gotten into the,
something like that.
Yeah, we haven't gotten into the marketing of it yet. I mean, if that's the market out here that we ought to be serving, it's certainly something we would consider. I don't think we're going to get a lot of kids. We talked about it, and reality is apartments aren't really set up for families. Do kids go in there with mom or dad? Sure, but they're not really set up for families. You know, like I said, it's usually transition housing. Vantages goes, somebody's having a house built. Well, they've got to sell their home because somebody bought it and they need a place for 6 months till their new home is built. Things like that. I would anticipate, honestly, on a national basis, only 21% of apartments have kids in them. I don't think we'll even reach those levels in this area. Just, I don't know, with where we are and things like that. I talked to one guy and I said, you know, there's concerns about kids. So I'm going to be single guys with boats up there. Okay. You know, but I don't think what you're going to see is families moving in. So, although we will still be paying impacts on school fees on every one of the apartments, regardless of who moves in.
Comment would be, you had mentioned self-storage kind of thing. It doesn't thrill me on that one.
Yeah, nobody gets excited about self-storage. I understand that. I mean, they're not exciting. They don't create jobs. There's another self-storage in town, but they're reasonably full most of the time. You've got boats in our, the one lady talking about the boats in the drives. But I personally don't think that's the highest and best use for the property, just because you already have one and there are no rental apartments here.
Actually, we have several, more than one. We have at least four out here.
You're kind of at the conceptual stage.
Absolutely.
So you haven't gone through the county, you haven't gone through the school board, as far as putting an application.
We have a lot of work to do. Yeah, so, you know, if everybody here said we hate it, we'd rather have this or that, it's just good information to have right now. We met with Supervisor Burgess, and she suggested we meet with the Mike and Fire Department, and we've got a whole lot of work to do. So.
My question would be for staff, and that is that was never in our general plan, another 125 sewage and water hookups, was it, for that area?
Well, we'd have to do a study to determine whether or not we could handle the water and wastewater capacity and what those impacts would be.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's something new. It wasn't allowed for in the previous study. Okay.
So we had someone else come and give a presentation for potential for apartments, and I'll say the same thing that we are concerned for that. My concern is traffic. 125 units entering 300 plus cars, if I calculate right. Bixler can't handle any more cars than it has now. The road, you can see with the cones, we've talked about that. We're trying to fix what's already here. If you add 300 more cars, that's going to be one of your biggest challenges to get that through. And then not disrupt this community.
Yeah, I understand. We will have to do a traffic report, and it pencils out that it's the impacts are too big and we can't mitigate them, and it's the project's dead.
Any other questions? Okay,
sorry, just have a quick question.
Yes.
So just so I can understand, you guys were just looking at the highest and best use of that particular property, and this is the kind of solution that you're looking at right now? Or have you discounted, is it light industrial still a possibility at this point?
No, nothing that I want to do. These guys who own the property and they're in the audience have been trying for 13 years with the office plans to no avail. So there just doesn't seem to be a market for any sort of product like that. One of the concerns Mike brought up was, well, what happens if it does show up? And you know, you've got two pieces of property right here that are zoned for general commercial, which can still accommodate offices, professional offices. I don't think we're ever going to see a large employer move out here because they have to deal with not only the employees that live here, but where they live elsewhere. So, you know, what you may get are professionals and services community, and there's land available to do it, and some of the shopping centers have some vacancies as well that may suit that.
Question? That's it. Thank you very much, but thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And you said you wanted some input, so we do have some a resident, Steve Boyd. I'll open it up for public to throw a comment out.
Good evening. Clarify, I'm not a resident. I'm one of the property owners. The other property owner is Tim Martin.
Thank you.
Who is here. I just want to make a couple of quick comments. Tim and I have been involved in Discover Bay for quite some time. We built the Sandy Cove Shopping Center, and then we purchased this property about 13 years ago. Question was asked, is there a chance for industrial? We had planned and processed an industrial office project on this property in 2007 before the market went down. And so the project obviously was never built. And since then, in the ensuing 10, 11 years, we would gladly have made an office or industrial deal on the property had there been any in the market. There just does not seem to be demand for that kind of product. We've known John for quite a while. He approached us and said he believed and his studies indicated that there was demand here for apartments, and we thought that would be a good idea. So we're here just to say that we think John's good at what he does, and thank you for your comments, and hope to see you a little further down the road.
Thank you. And I will allow you to come up and speak. Normally, we don't do this on presentations, but please feel free to come on up, and then please set off the timer. And you're bound by the same rules, 3 minutes.
Okay. Been out here for 43 years. And I've seen, there was hardly zero crime when I lived out here. The crime has risen, and I own apartment buildings in Antioch. The crime was terrible. Worse than Oakland. The police, they won't even go to certain areas. They won't come out alive. That's how bad it is. My tenants had to sleep on the floor at night in Antioch because the bullets are going through the walls and afraid of getting hit. And all these apartments, the single kids, brings in the drugs and the crime. Not only are our roads are so compacted now, that's one problem. I see the bigger problem as being theft, drugs, bringing in the really bad, especially if they're very low income. I liked your idea, maybe a senior development, because there's a lot of people out here becoming seniors and would like to stay in the community.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and close public comments and see no more. And thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
E4, master plan update on denitrification.
Bring up our engineer, Greg Reese.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm Gregory Harris, Hurwitz Engineering. I'm the district engineer for the town of Discover Bay. And as you know, we are deeply involved in working with Stantec Consulting Engineers on a master plan update for the wastewater facilities of the district. And one of the biggest issues of that is, what are we going to do for denitrification? What might it cost? And sort of what's the impact of Plan 1 and Plan 2? So we've worked through those issues, at least for that portion of the master plan. And my purpose tonight is to give you guys a quick update on the results. These results have been
It's just not working.
These results have been, go ahead. Yeah. These were presented at the wastewater committee, last wastewater committee, and here's the results for everybody. So the first issue we had is, what's the plan for capacity, number one and number two, once we do these two projects? Once we do denitrification treatment and modify those plants, what's our capacity going to be? And do we even need plant one? You know, the flows have gone down, some things have gone around. I gave a presentation a while back on the flows. And what we found was your water flow went down, but your biological load really didn't change much. That's what we found before. And so based upon that information, we've pressed on. What are we going to have to build? What's it going to cost? First thing is, what's the capacity of plant one and plant two? So based on our previous analysis, under the worst case design conditions of critical cold water temperatures, the design flow for the town is now 1.63 million gallons a day on an average basis. It used to be 2.37. That's, you know, 5 years ago when we did the master plan and we were planning facilities, it was 2.37. But the drought and water conservation and all these things have brought your flows down. But your biological load still remains high. But we're designing now at 1.63. So that's what we say you need. You need 1.63. But you need to be able to do that in the coldest temperature. One thing that we did find, which I'll bring up later, is your flows went down, but so did your temperatures. You know, for whatever reason, there's less water flow, they cool off more, and that affects the process. So the key here is the cold water temperatures are affecting your process. Based upon that, with the anoxic treatment at plant two, we had the capacity set at 1.45 million gallons per day. Plant one capacity with anoxic improvements is 0.79. But you can see plant two by itself is less than 1.63. It's less. It's 1.45. So under worst case design conditions, you're going to need plant one. Input of plant one is 0.79. The two together, when you operate them together, is about 2.24. So it's more than what you need together, but one of them by himself isn't quite enough. Next slide. In the warm water conditions, plant two has capacity 1.86. So warm water, you're not going to need plant one. If it's warm out in the design year, so we're built out, when all your stuff is built out, you can probably operate plant two all by itself. And then even with one oxidation, with one oxidation ditch out of service at plant two, even with warm weather, you still only get 1.37 million gallons a day. So your conclusion is, you need two ditches all the time. And at some point, you have to do maintenance on at least one ditch, right? So no matter what, for maintenance reasons, you need three ditches to operate. And then even in the design year, we're on the board that you're going to need three ditches, no matter what. So therefore, the future design flow, 1.63, plant two will be adequate most of the time, but not when you have to take an oxygen. It definitely is not adequate when you have to take an oxygen out of service, which is why we built it. It's why we built oxygen.
Exactly.
And that's why we did it. Okay. So the update on plant one, plant two is you need plant one. You're not getting by without plant one. So that impacts costs because we have to add improvements. We have to add stuff, right? That means we have to add it in two places. We've got to add stuff to plant two. We've got to add stuff to plant one. So there was a lot of hope about, do we need to keep plant one? Can we move on without it? This and that. Our analysis is you can't. We looked at it in many ways. We looked at flows and loads. This is where it lands. Okay, next. So then the question was, all right, we need plant one. We need plant two. How are we going to do it? So we looked at denitrification alternatives. We did a preliminary pre-screen. We got some input from different people, from Bernie, Mike Urocka, other people, just throwing out ideas. And let's say, go, we'll investigate them. Some of those ideas located in the anoxic basin in plant number one. Turned out that doesn't work. You know, like use plant one for just a portion of the process, do the rest over here, plant two. That doesn't work because we'd need like 42-inch pipes going here back and forth between plant one and plant two. We have to go under higher floor with those, and you need a massive pump station. Instead, if you use earthen basins at plant two, let's try and do it above ground with earthen basins. We don't get enough volume, we don't have enough space. It wouldn't be a reliable process, so that was discounted. Been a lot of talk about, what if we change the effluent disposal location? Right now we go to Old River. What if we went to land disposal, and because we went to land disposal, they would change our permit, they'd make it nicer on us. We've hammered that out, and that isn't going to fly. Mike Garocco put the last nail in the coffin this morning with a memo, but you know, the long and short of it is there's no guarantee they change our permit. In addition to that, because there's nitrogen in the water now that they want us to take out, they want us to take nitrogen out. If you apply it to land, then you put nitrogen in the land, and so then you got to grow a crop on it, and it's suddenly, you know, it spirals out of control. And so that one's out. We did look at the nitrification filters 5 years ago. In fact, we have kind of tested them, but you have to add a carbon source to those filters to get that. It was a methanol plant. It was going to be very expensive, so we discounted those. So those were discounted really by high-level analysis before we got into detailed analysis, which came next. All right, so then in the master plan, we jumped in and said, okay, we need anoxic basins are recommended. We've gone through it. We're going to do denitrification with anoxic basins. So now the question is, how are we going to build anoxic basins? What's the best way to do it? So I analyzed in detail two alternatives, below-grade concrete tanks or above-grade steel tanks. That's what we analyzed. Long and short of it, below-grade tanks were about 7.8 million. Above-ground steel tanks, about 11.1 million. One's less than the other. All things being equal, we would do option one, concrete tanks. So proceed with concrete basins. That's the answer on that.
And those costs are for putting in both plant one and plant two?
Yes, so facilities required a plant number one and number two, and those costs include.
That's total.
Yeah, that's
total. Cost of cost.
Correct, yeah. Good. All right, so while going through this process, we kind of stumbled along to some kind of things that have to be addressed a little bit. Not major, but they have to be addressed. So one thing that was very important is when the flows got lower, your wastewater temperatures went down. And initially, low flow sounded like a good deal. We had less work to do. It turned out that your biology doesn't like to work when it's cold out. He wants to get his jacket on and go home. He doesn't want to come out and do his work, right? So he slows down. The biology slows down. So you take a big process hit as you get colder and colder. And there's some graphs and stuff like that, and we found that there's really about a 5 degree temperature difference from where you were before, 5 years ago, to where you are now. So that affected the performance of the plants. So that was one reason the plants got derated a little bit. Additionally, we really struggled with influence sampling. There's a lot of variability in the influence sampling. And if you guys remember, in the wastewater committee, we authorized more sampling. We got more data. We completed TM5 on loads, flows, and loads based on that sampling. But that was a very short period. We really need to get a better record of data to go with that. So we have to keep improvements on influence sampling, and Bernie's working on with us on a plan to set up some more permanent improved sampling and testing, and we're going to stick with that because it's needed. It's needed before we finish design to just back up some of these numbers, because you know, we had a very small window for our previous sampling. You know, we're going to build a big long plan on that. We want to make sure we got the numbers right. Some other things that came up is, based on the recent sampling results that we took in our sampling, you don't need supplemental carbon, you're all good. Okay. But based on the numbers that historically you've taken, you might need carbon supplement. And carbon supplement would be like glycerin or sugar or alcohol to do it too. But basically, you need enough biodegradable food to get the oxygen, to get the bugs to take the nitrogen out. That's a simple way of it. We need food. You might need some food to take the oxygen out. Based on our recent sampling, you're all good. You don't have a problem. But based on your 5-year historical record, you have a problem, right? So part of the sampling is to analyze, do we really need it or we don't? You know, we'd like to be able to monitor record for that. However, because we haven't crossed it off the list, absolutely no, there's this $500,000 amount kind of floating around right now. Don't know if you need it. Don't think you need it. But we can't. We have a very limited data set to prove, you know.
And that would be for distribution of that. That would be for being able to add that to the.
Right.
That's a one-time cost.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, by the way, there's an O&M cost to that. If you had to do that, you got to buy that.
That's the other part.
That's just the capital cost. Right. Right. You know. But one of the benefits of getting on the sampling and staying diligent on getting that done is, we need to resolve that 500K as before we get into design. We need the data, you know. Otherwise, it's going to be floating around forever. Do we need it or we don't need it? You know. So that's one element. The other thing that we kind of came up with is based on some of my testing, the oxidation ditch rotors probably do not produce enough oxygen for what you need. We have a lot of basin volume, but the rotors are a little limited, and supplemental oxygen is likely needed. So in the master plan, we're just kind of putting a dollar amount around it and just saying, okay, design will figure it out. But we're carrying about 400K for supplemental oxygen. Any needs on that? Okay. So we have some immediate recommendations of things that we have to do. First off, improve the influence sampling and collect more consistent sampling data. And we have to do that right away. So we've already been working with Mike Garaka and Bernie, and we're working on our plan to get that done. But we're going to try and get that online as soon as possible and begin killing that data, because we really need some longer-term data to match the short-term data that we've done. Okay. And then once the new data is obtained, we need to just do some analysis. We need to do some monitoring. We need to do some readily biodegradable COD analysis. And that's where we're going to make sure that we have enough food for the process. So we need some data. Once we get the data, of course, we're going to analyze data. There's some other things that we need to consider. We think the rotors are going to be short on oxygen, but we don't know, because what we found is the rotors aren't drawing the same horsepower. The rotors are inside rotors draw different horsepower than the outside rotors. The books say they shouldn't, but we discovered that they did. Manufacturers like, yeah, I don't know if that means anything or not. We think if you don't put the horsepower in, I don't know how you get the oxygen out. But there's no documentation of any of that. So there's some, we should consider testing oxygen transfer. It is possible to test oxygen transfer. It would be a huge pain in the ass, but it is possible. Or we need to work with Bernie and talk about impacts of what does it really mean if we just say, let's go in not knowing the answer, but knowing how to mitigate it if it showed up as a problem, right? You know, kind of thing. So that's something to be resolved. And then, of course, in part of the pre-design, we'll have to excavate, investigate alternative supplemental oxygen. If we need that oxygen, how are we going to do it? And then, essentially, once you get this data going, you need to complete a pre-design. So a master plan is a big picture level document. A little pre-design report is, we're designing exactly this, and you have a little bit more finite data and a little bit more things tuned in to give you the exact project you need. So where we're heading on this is, we've got to keep our sampling up, and then the first part of design always is going to be to stop and do a pre-design report based on that new data you've been collecting, finish off some of these alternatives. In the meantime, the master plan is putting some big picture costs to try and estimate, okay, we think something like this, we think something like that, that gets refined in your pre-design report. So, what everyone wants to know, concrete anoxic base is 7.8 million project cost, okay? So that's not your construction cost, that includes your engineering and your management and things like that. Supplemental oxygen is in the range of $400,000. Possible supplemental carbon, $500,000. We think supplemental oxygen is probably needed. Carbon is not, but we can't check it off the list yet until we have better data. So that, but just playing it safe, that totals in 38.7 million. Okay, that's for improvements at plant one and plant two to accomplish the goal of denitrification under our permit. Okay, and so, just to let you know, that does not include rehabilitation of plant one. Okay, so plant one has clarifiers and oxidation dish, stuff like that. It hasn't been run for several years now. It's 40 years old. The clarifiers are 45 to like 40 years old. And there's some rehab there. If you're gonna keep plant one, if you're gonna keep it, and we say you need it, then you need to fix it. Because what you're going to do is, the day you need it, it won't run. It won't be there for you if you don't fix it, right? So we're carrying, we have a draft chapter 20 that we've gotten over to Bernie, and we're reviewing with Bernie to make sure we got all the costs needed. But separate from the 8.7 million, we're carrying right now in a draft chapter $4 million for plant one improvements over and above the 8.7. Okay? Now, we're going through a priority of this. We're going to go through priorities with Bernie. We're going to talk about some things here and there. But that's where we're at on that. And then, just as a caution, there are a few other master planning issues. You know, we're analyzing all the plants and stuff like that. So there's some medical issues that are floating around. But I know everyone's been asking, you know, what are we doing with plant one? And how much is this going to cost? And this is the number one. You know, here it is. Here it is right there. All right, that's what we're doing. and I'm here to answer questions. Now, one thing I did skip, just as a reminder, how did we get here? NPDES permit, right? So we have a permit that governs wastewater. Violating that permit runs usually around $9,000 a day. So if you blow that permit, that's your fine. That's a mandatory fine. You can't appeal it. You can't do anything with it. That's your fine. Okay. So under that permit, we were required to have denitrification installed by 2021, something like that. We have to work backwards from there because we got to design it, we got to build it, and then BERT has got to operate it for the permit changes. So what we found with the filters is we waited too long, and we turned the filters on 3 months before the permit expired, and then, you know, the first month everything was jolly, and the second month it all blew up on us, and we're like, holy shit, you know, well, it takes a little time to run new facilities out, guys. Okay, so we can't be hanging around like waiting till the last minute to start this. So the plan is we need to start as soon as possible. We need to start design, you know, September, October, we need to start design on this. And but everyone wants to know where we at, what we doing. This is it, those are the numbers. And you're in that ballpark.
Just a quick question. You mentioned about the rotor speed. I'm not an engineer.
Yeah.
But what if we just put on larger electric motors and spun them? A little more RPM, that's all.
You know, maybe. We kind of have to investigate that. What we're finding is both rotors, inside and outside, spin the same speed. One draws 40 horsepower. One draws 25 horsepower. Spin the same speed. So there's a hydrodynamic effect the way the water makes the turn. It's affecting the rotor differently. So it's not. I'm not convinced more speed doesn't. Because what we're really saying is the hydraulics of the water makes the turn and comes onto the rotor is behaving differently for this rotor versus this rotor. Manufacturers like, we never looked at it. It never occurred to us to do it. But we have a very measurable difference in the power. Like, one's taking all this power and one's not taking much power. Well, the oxygen transfer is usually proportional power. That's what we look at. It's like, okay. That makes us a concern. We're not getting the oxygen. We actually don't know for sure. All we know is that this one draws so much power different from this one, we surmise that they don't have the same oxygen. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. That's why we talk about maybe there's a test, or maybe we plan for some other things. But no one's got a perfect answer.
Is that phenomenon the same in both ditches?
Yeah.
The same location?
Yeah.
What's it take to move one of those rotors?
Rebuild the ditch.
Okay.
Yeah, so rebuild it. The rotor structure is completely independent structure.
That's how the flow goes into the ditch.
Yeah. Okay, that was a good question, as we're at.
So but we're not the ones with ox ditches. Obviously, it's used all over the place. Why is this a unique phenomenon with Discovery Bay?
Hey, man, it's what we call the manufacturers. It's what gives. That's the answer.
Okay. Couple questions. Our permits for 2.32, and you're talking about providing denitrification for 1.63. Is that going to affect what our requirement is to the state? I mean, we've told the state that we can provide 2.24. Do we have to then reduce our permit to that level in order to be compliant?
Yeah, so technically we do not, and at the moment I'm not planning on changing your permit. The reason being is whenever you try and get more flow, you know, last time we asked for more flow last time, they threw the filters on us, right? You know what I mean? So we ended up having to build something, right? So the key here is we create a planning document called the master plan for you, the district, for you to plan what your wastewater facilities will handle. You have a permit that allows discharge. You're going to keep that permit that allows your discharge to be what it is. But you, the community, have to know, we're counting up homes. We went through this earlier, right? We added up all the homes. We added up all the businesses, including where he had office instead of apartments. We added up all that, okay? So all that gets added up, and then we say, that's it. That's what we're going to accommodate right now. And you have to realize that. But we don't want to change your 2.32 because, hey, you could always build more stuff later, accommodate more homes, and you wouldn't have to modify your permit.
I just knew that was the question we had before. And then the other thing is that, if I can read my writing here. Oh, why is it, so if we need max at 1.6 and we can only produce 1.3, and I'm using rough numbers here from what I remember from this slide, 1.3, at plant two, but plant one hasn't operated for years. How have we been able to do that?
So if you look at it right here, so in the morning, you know, so first off, two things. You're not built out yet. You're getting there.
Okay, I'm with you.
So we are planning for the build out of your community, right? Now, you don't have a long way to go. You're 1.3 now, so you've got about 300,000 gallons left, right? So the first thing is, you're not there yet.
Right.
Okay. The second thing is, we have to add anoxic basins too, and that's modifying your process, right? So your process is running a certain way right now, and you're getting by with plant two just fine, right?
I didn't think Pantages isn't built yet. These other projects, we're not completely built out in Village 4 or Village 5 yet. So that's why we're okay, but we're not going to be okay when everything's done.
Correct.
I'm with
you. And then what we're saying, in warm weather, even a build out,
we'd be okay.
Probably fine.
A cold
plant two. But really cold weather, under heavy loading conditions, it's our job to make sure you don't get stuck.
Well,
you need a place
the county told us we're going through global warming, so it shouldn't be a problem anymore.
Yeah, well, at the moment, your flows are temperature dependent. That's all I can say. Your wastewater is colder than it used to by a lot. So what's going to happen next is this TM is draft. We've gotten comments from pretty much everybody on this. This is an update. This TM will go final. You know, the other TMs are final, and then we're picking up other things. Like right now, we're working on improvements to Plant 1 TM. You know, we're pushing as hard as we can to try and wrap this thing in September. But everybody wants to know so we can start planning, you know, how big is the project? And realistically, it's $13 million, plus or minus.
That's if you keep Plant 1.
14 million.
14. Engineer can't do math. You got me.
$14 million.
Well, we've also,
if we keep planning,
we didn't talk about the UV lamps. We didn't talk about
I didn't say this.
So I'll go back to the plant two. You didn't discuss that tonight.
Okay, so there is another memo we're working on, which is sort of a recap of something that was said previously, which is, do we keep plant one? You need three ditches. Doesn't mean it has to be a plant one. You could rebuild it at plant two, right? And you're gonna make an investment in plant one, right? I mean, you're gonna spend some money. You're gonna spend $4 million to fix it up, and you're gonna spend $2.7 million in new stuff that's not there now, right? So you're gonna make a $6.7 million investment in plant one so that it acts as a backup. You're not gonna use it very often. You're gonna use it as a backup, and you're gonna use it when you need it. Okay, but that's to make sure that it'll be there for you 10 years from now or 7 years from now or whenever you need it. It'll be there for you. You need plant one to do any of the construction of plant two, right? We can't even do the project without plant one. Like, if you didn't have plant one, this would be a way harder project. Like, we couldn't even go do this stuff because we have to completely empty out the basins and do all this work and construction to get this to happen, right? So if we hadn't already done that, we couldn't even build what we have to build now. It'd be a major, major process. We'd be building a third ditch of plant two is what we'd be doing, and then going one at a time and going back that way. So then the question is, what if we didn't build anything at plant one, just leave the headworks there and move everything to plant two?
And the reason, and just so you get clarification, and the reason that we threw that out there is we're spending $6.7 million on plant one to get us through a retrofit, a denitrification program. When we're done, we've got $6.7 million in plant one that's nothing more than a backup that's going to require constant maintenance to make sure it's ready as a backup.
Yes.
And so what if we took that and built it over to plant two, which we have real estate to do.
Correct.
It's whether we have the time to do it, but if we built it at plant two, we end with the capacity right there. And
right.
We do have issues, minor as it may be, but you've got to look at all of that, the cost to continue to maintain plant one. Crossing over Highway 4, which is getting busier and busier every day, multiple times. Security that's going into Plant 2 now has to be put into Plant 1. We've got electrical boxes sitting out in the weather where we've got them housed over in Plant 2. So we've got more money than just the 6.7 if we're going to maintain it there. So that's what led us to ask, what if we put it in Plant 2? Now I know the cost is going to be higher, but we've got to look at long-term cost as well.
Correct.
Well,
so
the maintenance cost isn't going to change. If you have wherever you have the oxidage, you still have to maintain it, and it still has to be operable, and it still has to be ready to be used when it needs to be used. So that's a moot point. the maintenance.
It may be. It might be easy, more easy to rotate some of these activities.
But you could still do that with plant, if we rehab plant one, you can still rotate to plant one and use it.
Yeah, well, so I'll jump in here. Okay. So the reality is, it is more difficult to operate two separate plants than to operate one.
Sure.
And the reality is, it's much harder to bring plant one online from scratch than an oxidation ditch that's adjacent to plant two. So there's no doubt that it's easier to operate, and I concur with Bernie on those factors. I think that operationally, it'll be really easy to maintain. Dollar-wise, it maybe comes out the same, but not having to cross Highway 4 all the time to maintain it versus just right there in the facility makes that easier to maintain. The real question, so we have a draft memo out. I'm working on that memo with Bernie. But previously, to move everything for plant one, so now there's clarifiers, there's oxidation ditches, there's stuff at plant one that we were going to rehab. To build it all from scratch is going to be in the neighborhood of $13.3 million at plant two. So where you're at, and you're going to realistically be in this decision, is, okay, I can put $6.7 million new dollars to rehab an old plant and put some D-Nite into plant one, or I can spend 13.3 plus 2.7 to build it fresh at plant two. Okay, so the question is, that's a delta. Is it nicer at plant two? Absolutely. Are there a lot of reasons that I wish was there? And as I was telling Bill earlier, when we built the plants, we were arguing with Hoffman 20 years ago, build it all at plant two then. Right? When we expanded plant two at the time, we built plant two, I wanted to kill plant one then. We told Hoffman, kill plant one then. Why keep putting money into this plant? It's gonna be difficult for that plant. You face that, the decision was made, right? But you're at this decision now too, and this is your last chance, because you really aren't going to turn your back on if you put another $6.7 million in, right? You know, you really aren't going to do that now. But just say right now, we're up for $14 million, and we're not moving it yet. You move it, and you're going to add $6 or $7 million more to that cost to move it. So you're over a $20 million project. Can we stomach that? I don't know. You know, I sympathize with Bernie, and I wish it was all plant two too. But that's a big delta, and I don't know if you're ever going to have an economic justification, you know, to say, oh, sure, this covers it. You know, you're just not. You're going to have to make that business decision as a district. What would you rather have, and what you're willing to go get to pay for it?
So when did, we don't have, we never accounted for the $4 million in our budget to rehab plant one when we abandoned it, or do we just,
okay, like,
so because that's not a new $4 million. That $4 million has been hanging out there for 10 years.
Correct. So
that's not new dollars.
Right. So there was a lot of discussion about in the last rate study how much improvements the plant one should be included. Okay. Some were excluded. Some were included. We currently have a CIP budget of about $1.5 million. Right. So I said, I don't care what you do, if you don't put 1.5 million in that plant, it won't turn on. If you don't at least do that. It won't, you can hit the switch, but the lights ain't coming on.
I know how that
happens. All right. But decisions were made to not include certain improvements, and that's where we're at. So on the CIP, we've been carrying about 1.5 million. Okay. We're going to work with Bernie, make sure our list is accurate. We're trying to create a list of really solid recommends and maybe some things that you can push off, and we are trying to split that list in that memo, things like that. But yes, this has been carried around, this has been kicked around for a while. And the reality is the plant hasn't been run for what, 2 3 years?
3 years.
3 years?
It was run 6 months. Monthly, but just a short term.
You just turn it off. Yeah, you know, so basically they try and exercise it, because if we didn't do that, it won't turn on at all, right? So. But it needs some work. I mean, the reality is that it needs some work. If you guys want it to be there for you, you need some work. And yes, so we're carrying those costs. So anyway, you know, we're looking at $14 million. And if you want to move it, you're looking more than that. And I would love to have it moved. I think that's great, but that's a pretty big delta. I don't know if you can support that delta.
Okay, and the reason I brought that up is I want to make sure that even though it may seem ridiculous, it's really a decision I want to put on the table.
It's a board decision. It's your money, it's your plan. What do you want to know at the end of the day? I mean, in one plant, you're going to get a 40-year-old rehab plant that's farther away, harder to maintain, and harder to bring online. and the other one, you're going to have a brand new plant that is easier to maintain in all in one facility and easier to operate. It's just a matter, is it worth it, right? It's just a matter, is that Delta worth it?
Well, it's a matter of what the ratepayers have to pay.
Right. So there's going to be a rate study, and I don't know. I mean, maybe you could, in the rate study's not for a while yet, though. The plan was, right, the rate study, the plan was, decide what we're going to do in the master plan, do the rate study. If you wanted to pull someone in to do some back to the ballpark numbers on 13 million or 14 million versus 20 million, what does that impact on the rate study? Maybe you could do that ahead of time. But the plan was, we're going to make a decision. We're going to put the number out for the master plan, and then we're going to hand it to the rate study group and say, okay, go figure out what you want to do with the rates. If you want to see an impact analysis backwards early, then we need to pull in somebody and get some analysis in a little early. If you want that input to help make that decision.
I think we should do that. I don't know what it costs to do that. I don't know what the time frame is. I mean, your planning still has to move forward.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Well, every decision we make now is a matter of days, it seems like, or weeks, if we don't have the time so to mulligate and discuss it. So I would agree with that.
If you want the impact on the rates,
yeah,
and you want that to help make that decision, then you should get a small contract. I mean, if you just tell the 14 or 20,
sure,
you know, without a bunch of fanfare, they can do some math for you pretty quick, and you get
that's an important
do a small that. Contract with somebody and get that analysis done.
Hey,
one thing I want to say about rates. Scary Bay rates are high relative to some communities because you're small and the way you're constructed is inefficient. Okay. Other rates are lower. You're going to have a big rate increase and everyone's going to say, oh, our rates are so much higher than everybody else. We're the first ones that have to go do this. Our permit was literally the month after the EPA changed the rules. That's when our permit hit. That's when we got hit with this. We're first in building the education in this region. Okay, so you can't just stop and say, well, our rates are way too high compared to our neighbors. All your neighborhood rates are going up. Grandma's going to go up. Everybody around you is going to go up. They're just behind you.
Whenever their permits do.
It's when their permits do. They're just behind you, and they're going to spend a bunch of money on their plants, too. It just hasn't happened. So you got to remember that. When people scream, they all scream, man, rates are too high.
Very important.
Anything else?
Any other questions? Very good. Thank you once again.
All right, great.
And with that, we'll bring up the OBI.
How would we proceed with trying to do a thumbnail rate study kind of thing? What would we have to do?
Dina, can you answer that? I haven't been through a rate study. You have.
Well, we do have it in the budget to do a rate study this fiscal year. I did think we were going to have a master plan complete so that we can begin working on that. So now we're going to thumbnail.
Well, we need numbers, and I don't know that we can wait.
Is it possible for Barlow Bells to take sort of the existing numbers and take some estimates from Hewitt and put it in there and say, well, given these ranges, that the impact on rates will be in this range?
Yeah, I think that Allison would give us.
And we'd love to see plant one without plant one.
He's going to give enough. They don't care what
I think it's the difference between you probably have to say 15 and 22 million.
Right. And give them the bookends and we'll figure it out.
The delta greater than that. You were at 7 million, not the difference.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, it was about right.
Yeah, we got 1.5 million in for plant one. Did you have that in there?
Yeah, that 1.5 million is
take that off that 6 point. You take that off that 4 million. Now you have 2.5 million instead of 4 million.
I'll let staff figure that out.
We'll get the delta.
Did you get the clarity on that?
Yeah.
Action plan and staff will take this.
We're gonna try to put that into action. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
that is an action. And it's got to be fairly quick.
Right. Would you be able to? I'm assuming you'd be able to have that for us at the next meeting.
That we'd have to get into contract, and we'd have to talk to them to know more about that.
Okay. Before you start talking about contracts, this isn't going to be a lot of money. They already have the numbers. They have the calculation. All they have to do is plug numbers in. We need a couple hours of Allison's time. I don't think we need a contract. contract. I think you have discretionary authority over a few $1,000. Let's just get it done. Let's not make a big project out of this. We have a big project coming down the road.
So if we could get that by the next meeting, then we would, I'm sure that this board would be able to make a decision one way or the other if we have those.
If we abandoned Plant 1, is there any value to that?
We've talked about that, but no, not really. Okay. That's not something we could figure into the cost.
You can't take that out.
And I would love to see those numbers if you could have ready for, and I know we have a committee meeting, water, wastewater, same day as the next meeting. If we could at least digest those a little bit there if you haven't read, if that's possible.
Call them tomorrow.
Okay. Good. Stop it, Bernie.
Thank you for the question. Bernie, you're up.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary, for putting us on the right path where we had to go. So, currently, staff continues to do a great job on the safety, which is 108,000 work hours. Thank you. Work here, Carol is off and on.
Okay.
So, soft safety, we did training safety for last month. Okay. All monthly and quarterly reports were submitted to the state on what quarter and other due date. Okay. All wells are active, running well. We did 125 million in production on water. Staff's been out flushing hydrants. We sit around the town. They did 24 last month. Okay. You can see our water production. We're still way below our baseline of 2013 before the conservation. So the next one.
So we're still following the trends.
Yeah,
July is always higher, but we're still maintaining that.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, we had about 21% reduction compared to 2013. So overall, we're still in a 30% reduction compared to 2013.
Nice.
Okay. Now that's 21%. Next. Wastewater. Currently, plant 2 is running beautifully. Zero flows, averaging about 1.2 coming in, 1 point going out, well below our permit limits. Only thing is our conductivity, and when the new permits in, we'll be in good shape there, because they did raise our limit on our conductivity. So we did get a break.
Yeah, finally?
It rose up to 2,400, so we're
nice.
And we did 4 more samples last month at our lift station to compare to see where we're still getting the high salt content, and so we're just waiting on the results from now.
That only took 10 years.
Okay, Sharon. Permit-wise, we did have one small SSO last month, back on July 11th, over here on Cambridge. A resident called us right when they seen it come out of a manhole, about 150 gallons. The line was packed full of flushable wood grease. Simply did, we just had this massive rag ball come out, but staff responded, cleaned it up in an hour. It was very small, so thanks to the resident who called it in as soon as they seen it. It was about 10:30 at night. Okay. Staff still out doing sewer assessments and manhole inspections. Okay, Carol. And staff